As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here with you again on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Remember to follow and subscribe, rate and review. My guest today is Mike Scott, the creative force behind the Scottish-Irish band The Waterboys, who've been active since 1983. This year they issued their 13th album called Where the Action Is, and that title track also serves as a coolest song in the world. So let's hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Mike Scott on your Coolest Conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
They say the sweetest victory is in defeat, and you can fool the whole world with just one tweet. My sister could jive, she had money, was cute, till she got crushed alive under Sommer's boot. Let's go, baby, where the action is.
Back with the Mighty Manfred, and I am thrilled to have as my very special guest today on our Coolest Conversations, Scottish singer, songwriter, and musician Mike Scott. How are you, Mike?
I'm fine, Manfred. Very well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And our coolest song in the world this week is a title track to your album from this year, Where the Action Is. Want to know, how does R&B man Robert Parker's song, Let's Go Baby, Where the Action Is, fit into your song's genesis?
Well, I heard Parker's number at a mod Northern Soul Club some years ago, and I thought, what a great track, but a fantastic chorus. And I liked his whole song, but his lyrics in the verses were about putting on your red dress and going out dancing, and of course, I'm all for putting on a red dress and going out dancing. I do it every week anyway. But I thought, gosh, I've got an idea for some more contemporary lyrics, so I fixed my lyric to his chorus, and then we got permission, and so he gets a credit on it and so on. It's all above board.
Did you know that here in the U.S. there was a 60s TV show, a kind of a Ready, Steady, Go, called Where the Action Is?
I did not.
Well, Freddie Cannon does a theme song, and it's called simply Action. But the lyric line is, you know, let's go where the action is. It's repeated throughout. That came out in 65, so I'm thinking maybe Robert was picking up on that. As you say, cool lyric, but yeah, your verses and everything much more elaborative than slipping on a red dress. Are you a man who still likes to hit the bright lit streets of night for action, or where is it that Mike Scott finds his action?
I do like cities. I'm talking to you from London, and I get a real buzz from being in a city. I get a buzz from the nightlife of the city too, and I do like to shake an old leg, yeah.
Well, the new album came out towards the end of May. When and where did you guys record it?
Mostly recorded in Dublin. Some of it recorded at Real World in England as well. And Where the Action Is done at Real World, that's Gabriel's studio.
So over the many years of the band, you've had a lot of different contributors or members. Are there any holdovers on this album from the 2017 release, Out of All This Blue?
Oh, yeah, most of the band. In fact, the whole band, I think, were on that record, too. It's got kind of more settled lineup these days. Mm-hmm. Do you know, we've had more members in the Waterboys than any other band in history, more even than The Fall and Santana.
Yeah, I was looking at live clips, and there's a bunch of folks up there. So the backing vocals on there, Jess Kavanaugh, Sini Summers, have they worked with you for a long while as well?
They've been with us for about 3 years, and that's Jess you could hear at the end where the action is letting loose in the last chorus.
Very cool. So my notes say it was produced by Puck Fingers and Brother Paul. Now, at least one of those guys is in the band with you. Can you tell us more about them?
Well, I can reveal that they're both actually in the band. Buck Fingers is my mixer name.
Oh, okay.
And Brother Paul is our keyboard player.
Oh, excellent. And so Brother Paul has been with you for how long then?
I've been with for five, almost 6 years.
Another favorite tune of mine on the album is Ladbroke Grove Symphony. And I believe you're on Ladbroke Grove right now.
Just around the corner,
Cool. Well, is that song, I'm guessing, about a time when you lived in or around the street in London?
Yeah, it was the early 80s. That was my neighborhood in London. Ladbroke Grove was famous for being a bohemian rock and roll reggae quarter. And it's still a very funky area. It's a little more gentrified now than it was back in the 80s. But it was a wonderful place to live back then. And, you know, I used to always bump into Mick Jones from The Clash, and I would see Joe Strummer on the street. It was a real cool area.
You said it was in the early 80s. How old were you then?
I was 23, 24.
You mentioned Nicky Sutton of the Swell Maps and the song. You collaborated with him some, didn't you?
I did some work with him on his records. Yeah, I produced one of his songs and I played piano on four or five tracks from one of his albums.
In the song, you mentioned him sleeping in your spare room, and I've only met him passing years ago. I remember back in the 90s, I was living in Athens, Georgia, and he was like couch surfing through the whole city. Seemed like quite a free spirit. What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, we were pals, and we used to strum guitars and sing together. And I also greatly admired his sartorial style.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very snappy dresser.
Well, you mentioned in the song that he was wearing your hat. He had a special fondness for chapeaus in general, or just your hat?
I had two cowboy hats, more than that. Now, back then, I had a blonde cowboy hat, a black one, and I used to wear the blonde one, and he put on the black one. We'd stroll around Ladbroke Grove.
Well, he passed away in 2006. Did you guys keep in contact over the years?
Very sporadically. We lost touch for a long time, but we made contact shortly before he died. He was writing a book, and he wrote to me. He got my email address from someone, and we were in contact very cordially, checking facts and so on.
When the song you sing about returning to the street, you know, after a number of years, did you really give it another go? And
yes, well, I lived around Ladbroke Grove from 81 to 85, and then I moved to Ireland, and from there I went to New York and then back to Scotland. And in the mid-90s, I tried moving back to that area, and it's like the song says, the stage was still intact, but it was with a different cast, a different play, a whole new pantomime, and I couldn't find a way back in.
Yeah,
I was out of time. And I needed to find myself somewhere else.
Where else did you find?
I moved to, oddly enough, I ran out of money and I couldn't afford to live in Notting Hill, Ladbroke Grove anymore. So I moved to the outskirts of London to a place called Kew. It's near Richmond, which you've probably heard of. And Kew was cheaper, but there was nothing particularly glamorous or exciting or countercultural about it. And the funny thing was that I found that actually I didn't need to be in a cultural hotspot to be creative. I could find the creativity just wherever I was. It was a great life lesson.
Oh, very cool. Now, the album closes with Piper, The Gates of Dawn, and that's a title I'm certain all U.S. Pink Floyd fans are familiar with. Not sure if they're as familiar with that a title as it being actually a chapter in The Wind of the Willows. Van Morrison also uses that title to a song that's clearly about that chapter. What is it about that particular chapter that resonated so much with you that you wound up writing music to accompany it?
Well, you know, all people of my age in Britain know that. The Wind and the Willows by Kenneth Graham. It's a children's classic and a very, very beautiful book. A wonderful evocation of the British countryside and also of British characters, because all the animals, it's a book about animals, but they all have human characteristics. Mole is the comfortable one. Rat is the sort of purposeful Evil One, Badger is the Mysterious One, and so on. And that particular chapter, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, is where the animals meet their maker, the god Pan. And it's a most beautiful piece of writing, one of the most evocative passages in the English language, I think. I've always loved it, and I always wanted to set it to music. And yes, Pink Floyd used, they only used the title. I can't find any reference to the book or the chapter in their album. And Van uses the title, and he kind of uses some lines from the chapter and just repeats them over a pretty piece of music. But neither of them credited Kenneth Graham, and he really is the author, the genius behind that chapter. And I agree with you completely. And books like The Wind in the Willows, also C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, which I've quoted from a couple of times, they're just part of my personal makeup because they go in early and they stay in the heart forever.
So Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch's UK hit Last Night in Soho, it's from 68, you were about 10 maybe then. I read that after hearing it, you decided you had to be in music. And I've also read that hearing Hank Williams was like a life-changing experience. So let's take those one by one. Most folks here in the U.S., I'm sure, don't know who Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch were. So how do you explain them, and why did that song, Last Night in Soho, resonate so much with you?
Oh, you know, it's not really true. It is the first single I ever bought. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was just one of many records that I loved. Actually, the Beatles had had a much more profound influence on me before. I loved the Beatles and the Stones first. Records like Paint It Black, She Loves You, Satisfaction, Paperback Writer, Iron Walrus. I remember being absolutely blitzed by Iron Walrus when I saw the Magical Mystery Tour on TV. But it was just that I was too young to buy records when those ones came out. But when I got about 9 years old, I had a bit of pocket money and I started buying records. And Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch happened to be the first record I bought. It wasn't particularly a world-shattering record for me. And it was just the first one I bought.
Well, that's a cool tune, though. How about Hank Williams? When did you first hear Hank?
Well, yeah, I came to Hank late. I'd read people talking about him. Dylan had talked about him. Patti Smith had talked about him. And then I heard Glenn Campbell singing I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry on a television special.
Yeah.
And I thought this was one of the most wonderful songs I'd ever heard. And Glenn did a particularly beautiful version. I remember there was a very touching harmonica solo on it, too, by the cat that was playing in his band. So I checked out Hank from there. And I bought a yellow-colored vinyl double album on MGM Records of all his hits. And that was a wonderful education for me. Also, I worked with the record producer, Bob Johnson, the guy that produced Blonde the Blonde and Johnny Cash at San Quentin and so on. And he used to talk to me about Hank. And I visited Johnson at his home in California, and he had the old piano, I think, from MGM Studios that Hank used to play. And I remember teaching myself Lost Highway in Bob Johnson's house.
That's all very cool. In fact, I have that same double album. It's like a yellow thing, and it's photos on the front. When did you get your first guitar?
10th birthday.
10th birthday. Was that a gift?
Birthday present from my dad, 68.
And so were your parents supportive of your musical endeavors?
Yeah, they were. I lived with my mom as a teenager, and she always was very helpful to me. She let me and my bands rehearse in the front room. She never complained about the volume. And later, when we had our first little shows, she would drive us there. She would kind of let me put the amps in the back of the car, and then she'd drive us there and come and collect us later. She was great.
So how, you mentioned your bands. How old were you when you formed your first band, and what was it called?
My first gigging band would have been White Light in 1977, named after half of Velvet Underground song.
I was going to guess. And so the rest of the material you played, was it mainly covers, or did you have original songs already at the time?
Oh, we did about half a dozen songs that we'd written ourselves or that I'd written. And we also used to do Waiting for the Man, White Light, White Heat, Heroin, We're Gonna Have a Real Good Time Together, which is a Velvet song that we learned from a Patti Smith bootleg, My Generation by The Who, stuff like that. Proto-punk, as I say, 77, so punk was a big influence on us at the time.
We're here towards the end of 2019. You have any plans to come stateside and play any shows anytime soon?
Well, we've just been for a tour, so next one maybe in 2020 if we're lucky. I hope. Fingers crossed.
I hope so, too. Back around 1983, you released the song A Girl Called Johnny, tribute to Patti Smith. On Where the Action Is, you've got a song called London Mick about Mick Jones and the Clash. Have I missed other tribute songs in your discography?
Yeah, you have. One called I Can See Elvis on Modern Blues. There's a couple on Out of All This Blues, our last record. There's been a few others over the years. Yeah, I like writing songs about musicians. It isn't a subject I know.
Yeah. Well, why specifically write about Mick? You mentioned, you know, seeing him on the on the street there in Ladbroke Grove. What possessed you to write a song about Mick?
Well, you know, he and Joe Strummer, I think, were equally great. And they took the two of them and the other cats, Simonon and Topper, to make the wonderful band that was The Clash. But Strummer gets all the attention, I think partly because he's dead and partly because he was so great. And Mick gets overlooked. And yet he was the architect of The Clash's records. He was the sound of The Clash and so much of their spirit. And I've had many encounters with him over the years. We're very friendly when we meet. It's occasional. And I thought I could wrap up our meetings in a song and pay tribute to him. So I did.
And he really did give you a Coca-Cola.
He really did. That was in 77. I went to the Clash show in Edinburgh, Scotland, and I tracked them down to the hotel afterwards and found them in the bar, and he bought me a Coca-Cola. He must have known I was just a kid. And then later we truly did go to the cinema and see Spinal Tap. It was the Electric Cinema on Portobello Road in London. So every word is true.
And he looks good in that Crombie coat.
Oh, yeah. Always a sharp dresser. Yes, like Mickey Sutton. Different style, but equally sharp.
All right. Well, Mike, we're going to spin this track, London Mick. Before we do that, though, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you very much, Manfred, and thanks for supporting the Waterboys and sticking with us and playing our record.
Absolutely. Right now, here's the Waterboys from this year's album, Where the Action Is, doing London Mick and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Sharp and slick, big hearted guitar man, London Mick. Come on, DJ, play my fix. Some rock and roll by London Mick. I first met him in the punk rock days. He was blowing through town in a punk rock blaze. I was a Clash kid under the spell. He bought me Coca-Cola at the band's hotel.
That was some of London Mick by the Waterboys here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track is on the band's most recent record album, Where the Action Is, and was inspired by main man Mike Scott's run-ins with Mick Jones of The Clash over the years. Thanks again to Mike for chatting with me today, and thanks as well to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. This is the Mighty Manfred, and next week I'll be chatting with Dave Sardi. Now, he had a big hand in producing The Who's new self-titled album. Sardi has worked with the likes of Oasis, The Hives, Tegan and Sarah, The Rolling Stones, amongst others. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it be slide, baby, diamond ring.